Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Good afternoon. This is Healthcare Today, and I'm Dr. Lewis Myers. We're going to talk today about pharmacists and the critical role they play in our healthcare system. That role has changed a great deal over the past 100 years as medical knowledge has vastly expanded and as society has changed. The kindly and independent pharmacist known as doc in small town or rural settings is now more likely today to be employed by a large hospital corporation or pharmaceutical conglomerate. We have three pharmacists with us today who will help us learn more about what these changes mean and the role of pharmacists today. First, we have Martin Irons, who got his undergraduate degree in pharmacy, the BS at Albany College of Pharmacy. He's been the managing pharmacist and certified diabetes educator at Beauchamp and O'Rourke, an independent pharmacy in Rutland, Vermont, from 2006 to the present time. He also served in the Army Reserve from 1982 to 1992. Samantha Malkus is a pharmacist at Rutland Regional Medical Center. She got her undergraduate degree at Temple University in Philadelphia and her PharmD, which is doctorate in pharmacy, at the University of Colorado, and she is board certified. And Dr. Emily Peel got her doctorate in pharmacy at the University of Rhode Island with additional graduate work in epidemiology and pharmacoepidemiology. She did a postdoctoral fellowship in infectious disease pharmacotherapy and a residency in the same. And she's going to talk to us today about antibiotics stewardship. And I do want, by way of disclaimer, to note that I work at Rutland Regional Medical Center, so that I do work on an ongoing basis with Dr. Peel and Dr. Malkus, and I'm always grateful for their help. I want to welcome all of you to our show today.
Thank you.
Hello, Dr. Meyer. Hi, Dr. Malkus. Let me start with you, and I appreciate you being with us. I know you worked last night, and getting by on very little sleep here today. But I really appreciate you being with us.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. You're the pharmacist. You take care of the entire hospital at night because you're the only person on duty at night, which is quite different than daytime. Tell us about some of the things that a hospital pharmacist does in a hospital of Rutland size, which is a regional hospital.
Well, we pretty much, like you said, on nights, another Emily, a coworker, and I, we are by ourselves. And we basically do the same thing everyone else does, and that's to look at inpatient orders that the physicians put through to us on the computer. We check for safety. Probably that is the most important thing. We want to make everything safe for our patients, that they're getting the right drugs and the appropriate dosing. We dispense medications that are needed. We do IVs. We do pretty much, we're kind of a one-man band. And we're a little bit different because we are by ourselves, but day shift has a little bit more of an expanded role where they look at things like the patient's kidney function and how that affects their drugs. They will actually speak to patients. They will do a med rec when a patient comes in to make sure that we transition their home meds to their inpatient meds. So it's quite a diverse role. And on different shifts, we do have an emphasis on different things. And, of course, we try to help out the nurses and the doctors when they have questions or any kind of comments about, finding something out for them or finding out information and for doses. So it's kind of in a nutshell, but it's quite a wide-ranging job these days compared to, like you said, 100 years ago, which is about when I graduated, but things have changed quite a bit.
Not quite. One of the things that I think pharmacists do in the hospital and in the outpatient is to overlook and oversee patient safety. And we've heard there have been a number of large studies done looking at errors that can be made in the hospital that impact patients, and a lot of those errors have to do with medications. Let me ask you a specific question. One transition that I think you've seen in the course of your time in, as a professional, is that most hospitals have gone from written orders, in other words, doctors handwriting prescription orders on a chart, to now electronic ordering through the computer. Tell me about how that made a difference for you and for the patients.
Oh, my gosh. It is probably the biggest change that has helped everybody. I've been lucky enough. I have graduated quite a few decades ago. However, I've always worked with computers. And as you said, it used to be chicken scratch from physicians. No offense. I think medical schools teach physicians to write really poorly. And you were trying to figure out what was written and inputting it into the computer. And it was sort of like data entry. So here we go a couple decades down the line. And electronically, the physicians now have control of what they want. It's clear. It gets into the computer. We review it. And the computer also is telling us, is this a duplicate? Is this unsafe? Maybe we need to look at the dosing. Maybe we need to look at the time. It will warn of potentially serious interactions. So the safety is just absolutely phenomenal for the patients compared to 20, 30 years ago. And the electronic revolution that has occurred has certainly made things so much safer. You don't have to spend a lot of time on deciphering things or just inputting information. We can now focus on the more important details about patient care. And as pharmacists, I think our number one thing is always safety, as I mentioned. But, I cannot even express what electronic gadgetry has done for us. Maybe 10, 15 years ago, if I had to look something up, I had to go to the library or I had to look for a reference that took a lot of time. Now we have Google. And we have certain references that are at our fingertips. So if a patient's in trouble and we really need to get our fingers on certain information, we can do it very quickly. And if we dispense meds, we can scan that against the computer. And the computer says, yes, this is really what you want to give to them. So I can't even, it's hard to imagine what it used to be, but, progress goes on. I used to work in a very large hospital, and you are so busy, and electronics and the computer and this age has given us a lot more security that what we're doing is safe for the patient.
Two of the important functions. Yeah, two of the important functions that you serve, and you've mentioned
absolutely.
Them already, are looking for allergies and looking for what we call drug-drug interactions. In other words, when medications interact with each other to produce, effects that you may not want or in times effects that might be helpful. Talk about some of those.
Well, and going back to where you briefly mentioned that medication errors have been a very big topic, there was a very huge study out of Harvard. And they didn't even look at just medication errors that occurred, but they counted anything that almost occurred. And again, having computers has really helped that. But what we like to look at specifically is if you have an allergy, we want to make sure that what we're giving you is not going to interfere with that. We want to make sure that if you have a penicillin allergy, you will not get anything, not just penicillin, but there might be something related to penicillin. And we also want to make a judgment that, you know what, you do have this allergy, but this medication is okay. It's similar, but this will be something that will help you. We'll look at that. We'll look at if you have this drug and you have another new drug, is that going to be okay together? Is it going to make the drug that you already are on not work as well or maybe work too well? So that's another big area that we're looking at. And we're looking at if you have kidneys that maybe aren't functioning quite well, that we're going to look at these medications and hopefully, you know, go through and make sure that everything is, again, safety. Safety is probably the primary goal that we all want to achieve, that you're getting what you need and you're getting it very safely. And it's appropriate for you. And, you know, by the same token, it's not that we just want to throw drugs at patients. We also want to take them away if that's what it's called for. We want people to not be on too many drugs, and we also want them to have what they need. So those are kind of the bigger things that we look at on a daily, hourly, you know, as we do our work. That's probably one of our bigger things that we do.
There are certain emergency situations that that call for very rapid action in the pharmacy, too, such as mixing certain medications or IV medications, bringing them up to the emergency department. Can you talk about a couple of situations that you might have to really move quickly on?
Well, we have, you know, most people who work in it, you can watch any medical show, and you can see that, you know, these traumas come in. Maybe there was a car accident and somebody has had a heart attack because, you know, part of the trauma. And we've had to go up because we've actually have assisted in code situations where we are making infusions or IV, when you see IV bags, drips that are helping the heart. Or if there's a clot that somebody has, there's particular drugs that are called clot busters, basically, and we go up and we'll help mix that and help. What has really changed too is that when I first got out of school, it was almost like an every man for himself. In the following decades, everybody has become much more collaborative. So we can run up to the ER and start mixing things for the nurses so they can attend to the patient and that the doctors can attend to the patients. And they don't have to bother with that. So I would say a code situation is one that's frequent and traumas. And sometimes some people come in, maybe they've taken, you know, way too many Advil in their time and they're having a GI bleed. And there's medications that we might make for that, to help stop the bleed or to assist in their pain. And it is very rapid fire that they can call us up. Sometimes we just happen to be there, and that's kind of another change, that we have pharmacists who actually are in the ER during the day, and we have a pharmacist who's in the intensive care unit, and we have pharmacists on each floor so that you do have someone there who can assist in a very short period of time if any emergency should occur.
And I can attest to how extraordinarily helpful that is, and that the knowledge base that pharmacists have really goes beyond what most physicians would learn in medical school. I remember a pharmacist many years ago when I was working in a different hospital. She was somewhat punctilious and precise. And when I asked, she noted that pharmacists know how to count their molecules, she said rather archly. But I think it's true. I think pharmacists in their training, particularly in the PharmD training, learn about the physiology and the biology of the body, learn about the chemistry of these, and the biochemistry of these medications, and it's goes far beyond what physicians learn. So I think we do rely on each other. Let me just ask you this finally. Some of these medicines that you're mixing or handling can actually be potentially risky for you. These are chemicals. Are there situations where you might find yourself at risk mixing some of these medicines?
We do. And again, over the years, that has changed. The most common example of that is the drugs that are given to cancer patients, the chemotoxic drugs. And when I was a student, we have these things that are called hoods, and it's supposed to filter the air. But people would just go in without gloves and without gowning up. And potentially, if you're spilling these things, it can get absorbed through your skin. So over the years, when now a pharmacist or a technician is making those drugs, they double glove, they have gowns. You sort of look like you're going in for an OR. And it makes it safer for the patient. It's in a sterile environment. It makes it safer for whoever's mixing, which absolutely it can be a hazardous drug. But even for our non-hazardous drugs, we actually also gown up like we're going to the OR so that the patient is getting something that's sterile and has very, very small chance of being contaminated. That's another big change that has occurred over the last, say, 10, 20 years. But for sure, there is a potential, particularly with the chemotoxic drugs. You have pharmacists that handle nuclear radioactive material. So for them, they have even a higher potential. We don't deal with that. That's a specialty of other pharmacists. So there are even other hazards that other pharmacists will deal with. But for us, probably the most toxic is the chemo drugs. But we do in a very safe environment for the patients and also for the people working in those areas.
Well, I think the watchword here seems to be safety, particularly for the patients, also
Absolutely.
For the pharmacists, and also helping the physicians and others in the hospital and the nurses do what they do or need to be doing at that moment. So if you would stay on the line, because I'm going to be talking to Dr. Peel next, I think. But, Sam, if you would stay on the line for a little bit, if you're able to
sure.
stay awake after your long night of work.
If you hear snoring, yeah, if you hear snoring,
All right.
Don't worry about it.
By the way, I wanted to invite our listeners to, if you have any questions for our guest today, we're at 802-244-1777. Again, that's 802-244-1777. So, Dr. Peel, you're with us, I think?
Yep, I'm here.
All right, thanks. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about PharmD training, because I think that's been another change. Perhaps in decades past, people did not go on. They stopped their studying a little bit before the PharmD track. What does a doctorate in pharmacy entail?
Yeah, so originally there was a bachelor's degree in pharmacy. Is very focused on safety, as Sam mentioned. And now in the past couple decades, they've added this PharmD component to it. So it's now a doctorate program. And what they are really trying to emphasize is more of a clinical role of pharmacists. Students completing a PharmD program are tasked with completing experiential rotations, so getting them out into pharmacy settings before they graduate, getting them on participating in interdisciplinary rounds, kind of utilizing their drug knowledge to improve patient care more beyond just the standard, just verify the order, check that it's safe. Pharmacists who graduate from the PharmD program, they're trying to really emphasize that pharmacists can help optimize therapy and make it safer for the patients.
How long did it take you to complete a PharmD? How long is that training?
So the structure is different depending on the program. Some students already have a bachelor's degree in pharmacy, and they can complete an accelerated course for the PharmD program in as few as 3 years. There are also programs that students can enter right out of high school, and they go into a six-year program. So that is what I did. It was 2 years of undergraduate pre-pharmacy coursework, so more generic education in chemistry and biology, and then they complete a four-year professional program to obtain the doctorate. One of those years is usually spent on experiential education out there in clinical settings.
Now, you have a special interest in training, postdoctoral training in infectious disease and in antibiotic stewardship. That is something of a new focus and a new field, but critically important. I think people need to understand what is antibiotic stewardship and why is it important?
Great question. So over the past several decades, we've come to realize that antibiotics are an incredible tool. They're so helpful for our patients. They have dramatically changed how we treat infections. And over the past few decades, we've realized that inappropriate use of antibiotics can create antibiotic-resistant bacteria. It's become a huge public health threat. I believe the CDC estimates there's an estimated 2 million infections and 23,000 deaths per year in the U.S. from antibiotic-resistant bacteria. When bacteria become resistant, we have to use more harmful, potentially toxic drugs, or we may not even have antibiotics that we could use because our infection has become so resistant. So in the past 20 years, I would say this has really become an emphasis from the public health perspective of we need to make a more collaborative effort to make antibiotic prescribing safe and effective for our patients. So now pharmacy, especially pharmacy students, can choose to specialize in infectious disease to learn more about these antibiotics to really help our physicians and our nursing colleagues optimize the use of them.
Do you think that physicians are as aware as they should be about the issues you were just talking about, and about in particular in terms of resistance?
Initially, no. But I would say the awareness campaigns that have occurred over the past few decades have really enhanced their knowledge of the problem. They've been very open to collaboration. They are looking for strategies to help guide them. So I would say we've made a lot of progress in the past couple decades. And fortunately, the physicians I've worked with and our advanced practice providers, they're very receptive. They want to know what is the best way to help keep their patients safe.
So give us, we have a couple of minutes before break, but give us an example. It's, if you were on rounds with the team, interdisciplinary team, how you might use your input to talk about the antibiotics that someone's on.
So usually when patients are coming in, they're very sick. We might not know what's going on. They might have a condition called sepsis, so their immune system is overreacting to the potential infection that they have. So we want to start them on very broad spectrum antibiotics, you know, to possibly cover any bacterial infection they have. So that's been proven to improve their outcomes. But those antibiotics are very broad. So throughout a patient's hospitalization, we may obtain more information, such as culture data telling us what specific bacteria is causing the problem. And that broad-spectrum antibiotic may not be needed anymore. And one of the examples, just thinking off the top of my head here, is a drug we use frequently when patients come in called vancomycin. It's an incredible drug that covers infections caused by the bacteria methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. But it also comes with risks, especially it can impact the kidneys. So while it's great to start out with, one of the biggest things that we do here as pharmacists is making sure that if it's no longer needed, helping guide our providers to discontinue it or at least keep track of how long we're using it and making sure it's appropriately monitored to keep the patient safe and hopefully prevent some of the adverse effects if they do need to continue on it.
I think have a lot of interaction with the people in the lab who are in the microbiology section of the lab itself. Is that right?
Yes, we work very closely with our lab colleagues.
And in terms of the antibiotics and the number of antibiotics that are being used, one of the problems is that pharmaceutical companies don't see a lot of money in developing new antibiotics because these antibiotics usually treat people for limited periods of time. And pharmaceutical companies tend to be more interested in chronic conditions where their medication will be prescribed for long periods of time. Is that a problem now, the fact that there's just not that much in the pipeline?
Yes, absolutely. So that has become a top priority for infectious disease specialists across the country, really partnering with pharmaceutical organizations. We know there's a need. As we see more resistance develop, there are high priority pathogens that we need more antibiotics for them. But unfortunately, there is not a lot of money in creating these new antibiotics for those infections because they don't infect a lot of people right now. Compared to other infections. And as you said, they are used for shorter courses than chronic medications. So there's really been a push to partner not only with the pharmaceutical companies, but also with the government. The government has tried to provide financial incentives to these pharmaceutical companies to help them streamline research and development of new drugs for antibiotic-resistant infections.
Clearly, as we've seen with COVID, that when there is a national emergency, that the pharmaceutical companies have the potential to move very quickly and remarkably in developing these medications. So we're going to have to figure out a way to do it for some of the less known but still very dangerous conditions that we're seeing. Dr. Pill, you mentioned at the start that there are 23,000 people died in the United States last year because of antibiotic resistance or their infections. Have you ever been involved in a situation like that?
Certainly. So we're very fortunate in Vermont. We haven't seen as much antibiotic resistance as other parts of the country have seen. Usually our patients are coming in with infections that may have developed a little bit of resistance, but we still have options. And the situations I've been involved in where we're dealing with extremely antibiotic-resistant infections, the death may not be necessarily associated with the infection itself, but the fact that we're giving a suboptimal treatment, a treatment with perhaps less evidence because we don't have any other options. And certainly one of the real things that propelled antimicrobial stewardship forward was the fact that many of the drugs that we have to use for antibiotic-resistant infections are very toxic. They have a lot of side effects. They can impact other systems in the body. And so, unfortunately, some of the deaths that we've seen attributed to these infections may actually be attributed to the antibiotic and the treatment themselves.
You've also done some postgraduate work on HIV, which again is not a disease which we have as much in Vermont as other states, but tell me about your work in HIV.
So I help out our infectious disease clinic here. We have both an infectious disease physician as well as an HIV physician. And you're definitely right, we don't see as much HIV here as we do in other parts of the country, but it's still important to provide those patients with the best care possible. And one of those aspects is making sure that the antiretrovirals that we use to treat HIV are safe for the patient. So as Sam already mentioned, making sure that there are no drug-drug interactions with their other home medications, making sure we're appropriately dosing for renal function, and occasionally making sure that if those patients are admitted to our hospital for a severe infection, that we're making sure that they're getting their home medication ordered to continue treating the HIV and covering for any other potential infections that they're more at risk for because they have HIV.
I'm going to ask you to stay on the line. We're going to be going to Martin Irons in just a moment, but I think we have a caller, if we can get him on, Rich from Starksboro. Rich.
Hi. I got a question for, I believe, Dr. Peel. Two questions, actually. The first one relates to the use of broad-spectrum antibiotics. I think she said that's the first line, but I'd like to have her comment about how broad-spectrum antibiotics are more likely to have adverse effects on the human microbiome. And then the second question is, I'd like to know who is doing antibiotic stewardship for the animal industry, for, say, dairy and the beef industry, which you're really using a lot more antibiotics probably than the human total humans in the U.S.
Those are terrific questions. Rich, thank you. Those are great questions. Let me have Dr. Peel answer briefly so I can get – then I'll go on to Mr. Irons.
Those are questions. So the first question, so talking about use of broad-spectrum antibiotics and more effects on the microbiome. So that's one of the reasons that we really, they're great empirically. When we're first getting a sick patient, we don't know what's going on. But we do want to be narrowing down, because when you're using a broad-spectrum antibiotic, you are killing or trying to kill many different types of bacteria. And as we know, the human microbiome, especially in our gut, contains a lot of bacteria that actually aren't causing problems. They're actually there, and they may be helping us. So when we use broad-spectrum antibiotics and we're killing those bacteria that might be helping us, we are potentially leading to more drug resistance in the future, but also contributing to bacteria that tend to proliferate when we use broad-spectrum antibiotics, such as C. diff. And we've really seen that become a huge problem over the past few decades when over-prescribing broad-spectrum antibiotics, such as fluoroquinolones, when they're not appropriate, can cause harmful effects by leading to either other infections, resistance down the line, or increased risk of developing a C. diff infection, which is an urgent threat right now, according to the CDC. And then on the second question, great, excellent question. There is a lot of antibiotic use in the animal industry. And for a while, it's been very unregulated. There's really no one cracking down on it. But I would say in the past decade, there's been a lot of collaboration with our veterinary colleagues. I've seen a lot of work come out of Tufts. There is a bigger program I've seen called One Health. So trying to collaborate more between infectious disease physicians, pharmaceutical organizations, our veterinary colleagues, and the very and our farmers who may be using these. So I would say it's not where it needs to be yet. We have a lot of work to do in that area, but it has been recognized as a problem, and ongoing efforts are being made to monitor that and find ways to improve it.
Thank you, Dr. Peel. And Rich, thank you for bringing that up. That was a very important point. Let me turn now to Marty Irons, who's the chief pharmacist at Beauchamp if I'm saying it right, O'Rourke in Rutland, outpatient independent pharmacy. Thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you've been a pharmacist for over 15 years. I believe you were a pharmaceutical rep with the insulin regimens before that. Can you tell me a little bit about how you've seen the world of outpatient pharmacy changing over the last 15 years?
It's really been, I'm actually licensed as a pharmacist a little over 30 years.
30 years.
It's been, yeah, but really in the last 10 to 15 years, to echo some of what Sam and Emily have said, it's been a very dynamic change. There's a lot more collaboration within different aspects of healthcare, bringing pharmacy into the fold. So here we are in Vermont, beautiful day in Vermont, and I'm sure you're probably most of your listeners can picture the traditional red barn in a silo on a Vermont farm. Well, pharmacy was that silo. We used to be out in a field by ourselves. Patients would bring us prescriptions. We would fill them. We would look for drug interactions. But we really did not have a lot of interaction with any other healthcare provider other than seeking refills of medications for patients. Fast forward to today, I have electronic health record access with our local hospital here in Rutland. So I can see lab work, so we can kind of take a look to see how medications are working. We coordinate care with doctors, of course, with discharge planners, patient case managers. We work with nursing homes and skilled nursing facilities. So this coordination of care is coming together at a very rapid pace, and all of this long-term and short-term really benefits patients and patient safety.
You mentioned that you're no longer in a silo, but one of the other developments in the last 20 years or more is that independent pharmacies are almost a dying breed. As I'm sure you know, the large corporations like CVS, Walgreens, Rite Aid, et cetera, have really sort of taken over the field in many communities. How do you see that developing, and is it a good thing, bad thing, or a mixed bag?
Well, you know, yes, there's been a consolidation within chain pharmacy, so there's less of them and bigger. Big chains are buying small chains. and have been for a long time. The real issue to maintain or keep a independent pharmacy viable is actually the reimbursement from the insurance companies. They're kind of they're huge. They have take it or leave it contracts. So if you sign a contract, say with a statewide provider like Vermont, only has a handful of commercial insurers. If you accept their contract, you're bound to their terms. There's really no negotiation, and so they've squeezed the life out of many independent pharmacies. 15 years ago, Vermont had about 42, and I believe we're under 20 at this point. So that may continue, though. State legislature is actually beginning to do some research and take testimony as to the effects of the insurance companies and the folks that actually manage their claims, pharmacy benefits managers, what the impact is for Vermonters.
When people go to the pharmacy, they're often told the pharmacist is on the phone talking with the insurance company about your medication, trying to get authorization, et cetera. How much time a day do you spend on the phone with insurance companies?
With insurance companies, not that much anymore. It used to be probably 15 to 20% of my day, and now it's probably under 5%. A lot of that, a lot of the things that we used to have to do by phone, we can do electronically now. But it's still, you know, again, it takes away from patient care, patient safety.
When you say patient care, you know, I mentioned at the outset that we had the old image of the doc pharmacist in town who did a lot of counseling of people coming to the pharmacy, and it perhaps sometimes they even went beyond their training, but nevertheless, they were someone who people could ask questions of. Do you find that you have time or that people are asking for your help in terms of understanding and learning about these medications?
Do I have time? I always make time for a patient, and I'm always excited when patients have questions, whether they show up, call, or they're receiving counseling at the time of dispensing. There's no bad questions. It's certainly to everyone's benefit if patients have a good grasp of what's happening with their medications, why they're taking it. And just to kind of move to the side or move to a tangent for a moment, our pharmacy was part of a Medicare-funded program a couple years ago where we worked with a senior residence facility here in the city of Rutland. And what we did was we coordinated it, again, through lab work with primary care and with other specialists. We looked at about 30 senior patients who either had diabetes or were pre-diabetes, so kind of on the verge of diabetes. And in a six-month period, relying on visiting nurses and the work we did at the pharmacy, we lowered patients' cholesterol on average, their LDL, their bad cholesterol, by 30 points. And we lowered their hemoglobin A1C, which is the measure of blood sugar, a full 1.1 point. That may not mean much to our listeners, but I think you'd agree, Dr. Myers, those are significant numbers.
Yes, they are. And that's a terrific collaboration.
Yeah, and it shows really what community pharmacy is capable of, and we're moving.
Do the big chains do the same sort of thing, or do you think this is limited more to the independent pharmacies?
You know, right now I see it more in smaller pharmacies doing that. The big corporations are looking at different medical models. Some of them have nurse practitioners attached to them, health clinics. Both of the two biggest, CVS and Walgreens, have announced new initiatives where they're looking at doing even greater initiatives with having prescribers either physically attached to the pharmacy or part of a little kind of mini network that can provide more access for patients. And you know, to go back about questions, as busy as we are, and we've never been busier, we are still the most accessible healthcare provider out there. And I think we all relish that. I think we take pride in being able
to. That's a very important point. Let me ask you about cost, because, you know, with our hospital pharmacists, I think most people who are in the hospital aren't aware, at least until they're discharged and start to get bills, about how much the medications they're receiving cost. But people who come to the outpatient pharmacy are very much aware of it because they may have a high copay or deductibles that they have to meet, and they're paying for increasingly large shares of some of these medications. How do you, are you able to help them in terms of guiding them towards certain generics? How do you counsel them about the costs?
Well, that's a great question. It's cost is certainly a huge concern, whether it's a working family or a retired senior citizen. With the seniors, there's Medicare Part D. Every year they have a chance to change plans, so we can make some suggestions in terms of, you know, good substitutions within the same class of medications, like cholesterol drug to cholesterol drug, diabetes drug to diabetes drug. Sometimes it's a matter of just looking, look at the lab work to see if the drugs they're taking are really providing them any benefit, or can they even cut back on a dose? And sometimes that happens. There are insurance programs out there. There are manufacturer programs out there. There are programs for indigent. The state of Vermont provides a great program for seniors to help with copays. And the Council on Aging does a tremendous job of either helping seniors directly or reaching out to us, providing a scenario of the person who's in front of them with problems. And we can also provide some advice right then and there.
And I think, you know, I would say, having been a primary care provider for some years, that pharmacists are probably much more aware of the costs and the potential generics or other medicines in class that patients might benefit from and be able to control their costs. So I think you make an important point. Let me ask you about one medicine in particular, and I ask because you had experience as a pharmaceutical rep many years ago in helping sell insulin. As we've mentioned on previous program, insulin was officially developed 100 years ago this year in 1921. So it's a 100-year-old medicine, and yet in recent years we've seen the cost of insulin skyrocket so that many people who are diabetics are no longer able to afford to use insulin in the way it's prescribed. They have to use only partial doses or sometimes not at all. How do you explain this?
This kind of goes back to where I spoke about insurance companies and pharmacy benefits managers, the folks that handle the contracts. There are a lot of hidden rebates. So a pharmacy benefits manager may have a choice of three insulins that are used with meals, but will only approve one. And that particular one that gets selected is providing a rebate back to the pharmacy benefits manager. So, yeah, insulin prices have skyrocketed. I'm also a board-certified diabetes educator and have been for about 25 years. Before I became a rep, a vial of insulin was $10 to $12 on the low end and $25 on the high end, and up until a couple of years ago, they were really, vials had moved up to the $175 to $250 range, with some exceptions. Because there's a lot of public pressure, many of the insulin manufacturers in the last year have come out with their own generics of their own products. So there's some relief there, but insulin can still be a tremendously expensive product. For seniors, again, most of them have the option of getting some help with their copays, so it makes it affordable. But for working families, boy, yes, like you said, studies have suggested up to 25% of patients are rationing their insulin.
I think this makes people, a lot of people, kind of angry, because I think so much of it is lacks transparency. We have all these pharmacy benefit managers who are not seen by the public. They're working behind the scenes, and all of these sort of bargaining going on that patients are not really privy to. But are subject to. So it goes beyond what we can figure out on this show. But I think it's an issue that certainly across the country people are aware of and would like to see changed. Let me ask you about opioid abuse, because obviously not only in Rutland, but throughout Vermont and throughout this country, the opioid abuse problem has just mushroomed. And some of it has to do with prescription medications, as we know. And pharmacists are now on the front line for monitoring this. Tell me about what your experience has been.
Oh, gosh, this could be a two-hour show, Dr. Meyer.
Well, we've only got 5 minutes, so.
Yes, Vermont is very typical. Rutland is very typical in terms of what's happening. So, yes, opioids became, 25 years ago, opioids were kind of reserved for surgical patients, cancer patients, people that had burns for major opiates, strong painkillers. But the marketing changed, some views changed. The DEA was lax in terms of keeping an eye on what was happening in the marketplace. And essentially, painkillers that weren't commonly available became commonly prescribed. And it definitely led to a cycle of addiction 20 years ago that we're still trying to face.
Could you see that happening on the ground, right, where you were?
We would see patients from Rutland, and again, Rutland's, I'm not picking on Rutland, it's just where I practice, get on the train and go to a specific prescriber in Long Island just so that they could get their OxyContin prescriptions because they may not have been able to get those locally. We would have cars with Florida license plates and West Virginia license plates show up with three or four people, each with opioid prescriptions in hand wanting to fill them. No, we don't do that.
There is something called the prescription monitoring plan, which is really, really important. We only have a couple minutes left. Can you briefly tell us what that is?
Yeah, so about 12 years ago, the state implemented a program where they collect the data from every pharmacy in Vermont every night when we finish. Our controlled substance records go into this database. So if a patient shows up, first of all, if it's a new patient with a controlled substance, I'm obligated to check their controlled substance history. So I can look them up. I can look at adjoining states. I can see what medications they got, when they got them, who prescribed them, where they got them. And it helps to figure out things. It's a guide. It's not something that says, yes, you can fill it. No, you can't. It's just there for informational use.
Has it made a difference? Has it helped?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's a helpful tool. It's a very helpful tool.
Well, I think that there's a lot more we can talk about. You're on the front lines. Dr. Malkus is on the front lines in the hospital. Dr. Peel is on the front lines and is helping us, guide us in terms of using antibiotics wisely, because as we've seen, they're tremendously helpful, but they can also be harmful, and drug resistance is an increasingly major problem. I want to thank all of you. I think that this is the pharmacy field in particular is an evolving field, and I think having a yearly show on what's happening in the world of pharmacy would be really helpful, because it's an area where everyone probably goes to a pharmacy at one time or another. We didn't even mention vaccines delivery, which has been also a huge help. As Mr. Irons mentioned, some of the pharmacies are moving toward actually becoming primary care type settings or urgent cares. So we'll need to talk about that more as well. But I want to thank all of my guests. Thank you, and thank you to all three of you. And I hope you'll join us next week. In the meantime, please be kind to yourselves, be kind to others.
Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, brought to you in part by Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Westview Meadows and the Gary residence. Retirement living the way it's meant to be. Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com. Employee owned and locally committed. Northfield Pharmacy. Pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. NorthfieldPharmacy.com.
The music for this program was written and produced by Armin Bayajian.